Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, and every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between all of those things, talking about everything that affects our personal health and well-being, as well as everything that affects our community, our society, and the earth itself. All of these things are interconnected. For many years, I was a reporter on, and in fact, I continue working with doctors and looking at all the great things we can do to protect our personal health. But if we allow government policies and business practices to create a whole wide range of health and environmental harms, we won't have healthy communities, healthy food, water, air, and earth, or a healthy society or planet to live on. So that's what we do every week on Connect the Dots. We discuss all the different facets of what it takes to create a healthier world for all of us to live in. So, you know, usually that means that a lot of the things we cover on the show are not, you know, the good news items that are going to, you know, maybe make you feel thrilled and uplifted. Instead, they're things that we need to pay attention to, and they may evoke feelings of concern and worry. On this show, what we always do is we direct toward activism in response to that. So, you know, that's the way. And so you'll hear throughout the program and through many of the programs that I run, you know, many different suggestions of how you can participate in making our world safer and healthier and more centered around health and protecting our home here, planet Earth. On today's show, I'm really thrilled because we're going to be welcoming back a guest that we had a few weeks back. As many of you know, if you're a regular listener or if you're new to it, you'll be learning about it. I've been covering the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other trade agreements that are on the slate right now. So this show, if you're listening to it in February, March, you know, or as opposed to, say, later in archives, is very timely in terms of getting informed and taking action. So I'm thrilled to have our guest returning for the second time because he is such a, you know, an important and knowledgeable person about what we are dealing with here, which is pretty serious, as you'll learn more about during the program. His name is William Warren, and he is a senior trade analyst with Friends of the Earth. We've had him on the show before, and I'll refer to that later and reference that in our archives as well, because he's really been somebody who has the background and the training and the professional chops to really be discussing this in depth. I mean, we can all discuss it and inform ourselves and learn about it, but it's great to do so from someone like Bill Warren, who is so incredibly knowledgeable and whose field of endeavor this is. Again, he's a senior trade analyst for Friends of the Earth, and he works to protect the environment from the negative impact of international trade and investment agreements. Contributing to the policy discussion about trade and environmental issues as they arise in our communities, in Congress, in federal agencies, in international negotiations like what we'll be talking about today, as well as lawsuits that result from some of the things we'll be discussing. Before coming to Friends of the Earth, Bill worked at Georgetown University for over a decade as policy director of the Forum on Democracy and Trade, as well as an adjunct professor at the Law Center. He's also been a senior fellow at the Harrison Institute of Public Law. He is, by training as well, a lawyer with a JD degree from Duke Law School, as well as another degree from Georgetown University. He's been studying these treaties for many, many years, and I've interviewed and featured six programs to date, and I guess this is our seventh. Hopefully that'll be the lucky number on this issue. And he is extremely well-informed. Today we're going to be talking about, you know, we'll do an introduction to, you know, what these agreements are about for listeners to whom this is entirely new. And then we're going to focus in a little more about the effects that this will have on our ability to eat healthy food and have a healthy food supply, which is an extremely, you know, that's something that we who are health-oriented care very deeply about, and which we all must care about. All people on some level do care about it. So welcome back to Connect the Dots, Bill Warren.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure.
So let's just, for listeners who may be new to this, let's just talk a little bit about these treaties. One of the things that I think we've seen is that when people hear the word treaty, they kind of think, oh, that's up there in the stratosphere. It's kind of going on somewhere else far away from me. It's not something that I would have any say in or need to know anything about. But in fact, as you have pointed out, these agreements, these international agreements between multinational corporations are, you know, being called treaties, and that they're kind of flying a bit under a false flag. Could you orient our listeners a little bit to that?
Well, sure. Over 20 years ago, before NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, trade agreements really focused on trade, which means things like market access and non-discrimination at the border, and you know, seeking to increase the volume in trading goods and services. But since NAFTA and the WTO agreement, we've seen an entirely different kind of international agreement, which is branded as a trade agreement, but really is as much or more focused on deregulation, based on sort of the Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan theory that government is the problem, and that trade will increase and our prosperity will increase if we get government out of the way, get rid of those pesky health and environmental regulations, and let the market work a miracle. And of course, this is more theology than economics, and not a very pleasant theology at that. And what we see here in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is pending, and a Transatlantic Agreement, which will be coming down the pike soon, an attempt to use these agreements to freeze in place and roll back environmental regulations, but especially regulations that are intended to protect the safety of the food we eat.
Now, that's of tremendous concern. You know, in one of the things that I often hear people say in the health and food communities is, you know, vote with your pocketbook. If you want healthy foods, you know, buy them. That, you know, is like sending a message that's almost as good as a vote, you know. And then, you know, and in fact, people have been doing that, and the organic food industry is the fastest growing sector of the food industry. You know, the other sectors may dominate, but they're kind of stagnant because we've done a good job of, you know, kind of making the case for food and nutrition as foundational to health. And, you know, we, meaning those of us who are health advocates, doctors, experts, nutritional experts, and others, you know, have really pointed out something that, sadly, conventional medicine kind of missed, which is before we get all these diseases, you know, that need these dreadful, costly interventions, pharmaceutical, surgery, whatever. It's great that they're there if we need them. But, you know, instead of just kind of rolling along without knowing what we can do for ourselves until we get to a point where, you know, we have diseases and that those are our best options or our only options, or sometimes there are also other options at any point in time. But instead of just rolling along without doing anything, one of the prime things that people do who care about health is eat healthy food. And then the assumption is, well, if we're doing that, if we're supporting that, you know, the market will talk. That's what we've been told. But in fact, that isn't the case. Without the proper regulatory framework, without the proper laws, without the proper labels, you know, without the proper subsidies, you know, the government and industry can really kind of intervene and make it harder and more costly and sometimes even impossible to get the healthy foods that we want and that we think we're voting for when we go to the farmer's market or whatever. So, you know, we're talking about food and food safety today. How would this pattern of regulations that we have now, not ideal in many ways already, be shifted or worsened from the perspective of those who care about healthy food if these deals go through?
Well, it's really insidious, and it's a several-tiered rollback of safeguards, and it's a very direct attack on the consumer's right to know and make those kind of market decisions to protect the food that one eats and that one feeds to one's family. And at the broadest level, there are provisions in the Pacific Agreement and the Atlantic Agreement that would affect the capacity of government to regulate food safety. And we can expect from the Pacific deal a tsunami of unsafe foods from Asia in particular, and fish and shellfish from places like Vietnam in particular, you know, factory fish farmed product that's been, the products, the fish or the shellfish are produced in filthy conditions, fed lots of dangerous antibiotics, and treated with dangerous chemicals. And then under these agreements, there would be a decision to provide mutual recognition of the safety safeguards in places like Vietnam and those in the United States. And so we would just be buying a pig in the poke. We wouldn't have any way of knowing that the food is unsafe when it arrives at our ports, because we might very well have to accept the Vietnamese claim that the food is safe, even though it patently isn't. And furthermore, the increased volume would overwhelm, the very meager at-the-border inspections that we have. And then the worst thing of all is there's a specific provision in these agreements that is intended to roll back food labeling. You know, that's environmental labeling, organic labeling, labeling that lets you know, whether it's tuna fish that's been caught in inhumane ways, labeling that we let you know the country of origin of meat, labeling that would let you know what chemicals and pesticides, have been used in the production of the food. So it very much is intended to unleash, as I said before, a tsunami of unsafe foods, and then to deny the consumer the capacity to make that choice in the marketplace. So it's really not a free market agreement at all. It's a pro-corporate agreement that would allow them to sell their goods with no oversight and no consumer choice.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really, really bad, because here in this country, many people have been, wanting labeling of food additives, of food coloring, because they can, they've been associated with hyperactivity in children, wanting to know the contents of something like high fructose corn syrup, which is, addictive. It contributes to the obesity epidemic, as well as, of course, the GMO labeling, or any product at all. Like, we got trans fats out of food, which were, put in there supposedly safe by the food industry, but the reason we were able to get them out is because we were able to identify which products they were in and avoid them. So the public's right to both protect themselves and to sort of vote with their consumer choices is really reduced, not to say eradicated, with this kind of change. But let's step back. We'll talk about that more, but let's just step back for a moment and let's get a clearer understanding. From what you said, I think it's certainly news to me, and I'm sure, it's very likely news to most of our listeners, that the idea that, agreements around food safety would result in flooding of U.S. Grocery stores and food outlets and marketplace with poor quality of Vietnamese food is, you know, food from Vietnam is really kind of, I've never heard of it before. What are the problems with that food?
Well, you know, you're talking about chemicals that are associated with autism, with cancer, breast cancer, other cancers that's associated with hormone problems.
You're saying they're
in animals
and
babies.
In produce or packaged goods, or what kind of foods would contain the things you're mentioning?
A lot of produce and packaged goods would be affected. I mean, so a lot of the produce has been treated with dangerous pesticide. You know, the fish and the meat has been treated with hormones and chemicals, antibiotics. And, of course, the processed food is laden with a variety of chemicals and other ingredients that are associated with serious health problems.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, and would you say that on a par with, you know, the typical American foods, are they actually using worse ingredients than what we would typically use now, I mean currently, or just that they're using the same thing and we kind of don't know about it?
Well, a lot of it is we don't know because there's no effective oversight of how this, how the produce and the meat and the seafood products are produced in some parts of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's the case that compared to Europe in particular, food safety and food labeling standards are quite low in the United States. And mm-hmm. one of the major goals of the Big Ag in the negotiations for the transatlantic trade deal is to knock down those European standards that require GMO labeling, that restrict the importation of food that's been treated with dangerous chemicals and antibiotics and so forth. So that's one of the major goals is to make sure that the European standards do not become a model for the world, which, and they're not a total perfect model, but they're a lot better than anybody else's, and they're a major target in those negotiations. And then we see a desire to use these trade agreements to preempt and stop the states from providing for better labeling and better food safety standards than are provided at the federal level in the United States. That's mm-hmm. another top political and economic target for Big Ag. You know, go after European standards, go after tougher state standards, and then also to offshore a lot of the production from farms in the United States and meat producers in the United States and send it to Asia where conditions are really bad and where the environmental and safety protections are even worse than the United States.
Wow. So let's just kind of take some of these things kind of a little bit, one at a time. So on the one hand, you're saying that this is like also an outsourcing of jobs. So the sense that, you know, oh, we need this for jobs and this is going to help us out here and, you know, there'll be more flowing toward our economy is actually, that it's actually the opposite. If, in fact, we're going to be getting a lot of cheap food from elsewhere, that's not going to be growing our economy, per se. For those, since we are in a time, obviously, of economic downturn, obviously that's a concern. The other thing, though, that I find really striking in all of this is the notion that European higher standards are on the table to be kind of deregulated or softened or undone. I was just at an event, a book launch, with a woman named Vani Hari, who's known as the Food Babe. She, you know, is very popular for sort of speaking truth to power to the big food companies about some of their additives, and I think she has become a focal point and sort of represents for a lot of people you know, a sense of empowerment. We don't have to just kind of take this food. You know, she's gotten BHT out of cereal, and, you know, she's fighting that. And so she'll focus on an ingredient and then go to the company, and, you know, tens and hundreds of thousands of people will follow her lead and sign petitions and apply pressure to these companies to get them to improve the quality or take out problematic ingredients that are in these packaged foods. But, you know, one of the things she frequently, and she's also an advocate of GMO labeling, one of the things that she frequently points to is that Europe has better standards. Europe labels GMOs, they have better food safety standards, you know, all of that. And so she's constantly pointing, and as a result, in fact, U.S. companies, if they want to sell a product in Europe and the European Union says, no, that, you know, contains an ingredient that's on our no-no list, they have to reformulate and do a different product for Europe. And one of her arguments is, why are we doing, you know, a healthier product for Europe? And then we're, you know, giving Americans a product that contains additives that have been associated with health problems of one kind or another. And so that's one of her big, you know, talking points. And yet, ironically, what you're saying is that the European standards are, you know, at risk and being pulled down, and they would have to go along, instead of us getting, let's say, BHT or something else out of our cereal, they would have to take out the provisions that protect their food supply. Now, I've mentioned this to a couple of people, you know, who are activists in these areas, and you know, what they tell me, what people have said to me is, oh, that'll never happen. Europe, they wouldn't sit still for this. Don't worry about it. Don't worry your pretty little head about it. You know, that will never, ever happen. You know, Europe will fight back. Well, is Europe fighting back? Do people in Europe know about this? How likely is this to actually occur?
People in Europe do know about this. There's a citizens' movement that has arisen there because of concerns about the, for example, the U.S. chicken that's been soaked in chemicals like chlorine and on the GMO labeling and a whole variety of other things. And so these people are pretty shrewd, and they've found a way to try to convince the European people that that these safeguards are not on the table, because they are now focusing less on identifying particular European safeguards to immediately take off the books, but rather to institute a system of regulatory review. It's all very obscure, but it's a process that guarantees the same outcome of knocking down the standards. And what it's based on is, before that you can promulgate or enforce a food safety standard, it has to go through a regulatory review committee that includes representatives of the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, not U.S. food regulators, but trade negotiators, and industry representatives. And they would be in a position to roll back and kill these regulations in Europe completely behind closed doors and without any public scrutiny. And in the process of reviewing it, they would rely very heavily on something called cost-benefit analysis, which says that you know, any kind of risk you can't quantify, any attempt to apply the precautionary principle is out of bounds. And that, in fact, you would measure the risk of food in terms of, you know, the economic cost of health care and the price that they would attribute to a human life. And they would accept a fairly high cost in terms of decreased health and lives lost if, in the cost-benefit calculations, the increased profits for the corporations were higher than their understated, to say the least, attribution of a price to human life and human health. And I have to say, the very idea that you're putting, you're trying to attribute a price to the priceless, it just shows how offensive this is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an academic exercise at all. It's one that will be run behind closed doors with big ag corporate representatives at the table and the staff of the U.S. Trade Representative, which has a deregulatory agenda on the table, you know, at the table. And in the same way, the Europeans would be represented by trade officials, not food safety officials. And so you see a game that they're playing here by trying to impose a process that will arrive at the same outcome. In fact, probably be even more devastating across the board in terms of food safety. But they're playing, as we say, hide the ball, because they've had such a powerful pushback from the people. And you know, and this is the where it's this is the terrain upon which this fight is being conducted right now in Europe, because public opposition to the U.S. attack on food safety there is a major issue. I mean, I talked on the major German public television station, and they ran a show on this, and people know about it. The mainstream media there is much more willing to cover this issue than the mainstream media of the United States, and so it's quite a fight. And this process, cost benefit process, is their way to try to sidestep the fight.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that instead of being part of the treaty, what the treaty will put in place, if it's voted through Congress in the next month or two, is, you know, the signing of that or the agreement or ratifying of that, what it will put in place is a behind-the-scenes process that will then, you know, proceed to move forward and undo, you know, the regulations behind closed doors where people won't even really know about it. I mean, that's what I hear you saying there.
Well, that's with respect to the Atlantic deal. With the Pacific deal, mm-hmm. it'll be much more on the sleeve. You will see very direct rollbacks of important food safety mm-hmm. provisions, and especially this idea of mutual recognition of other countries' safety standards and the fact that you wouldn't have people in sufficient numbers at the border to check the flood of very unsafe food coming from Asia. So the Pacific deal is maybe the more immediate threat, but the Atlantic deal with all these quote unquote process approaches would be the longer term threat.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's horrible, of course, but very clear. Let's talk a minute about, one of the things I hear from people is, like, for example, recently President Obama went on the, I guess he was interviewed by Ezra Klein, and he said, we have to do this because if we don't sign on for these deals, then the entire process of, you know, what goes into law will be set up by China, and China will do much more onerous, deals than we would set up. So, it kind of really behooves us to set all this up and to be, you know, kind of driving the bus here. You know, otherwise it'll be China. So I have a follow-up question to that, too. But, you know, your thoughts on that, on that as being what's really going on here and the rationale for that?
Well, that's not true. Mm-hmm. The Chinese are attempting to negotiate some much fuzzier sorts of regional trade agreements that do not include the kind of onerous pro-corporate provisions of the kind we see in U.S. agreements. Now, there are problems with that approach and so forth, but they're really largely non-binding. The thing that makes the U.S. agreement so very dangerous is that they can be enforced with retaliatory trade sanctions that would, you know, hit exporters in the United States if we didn't lower our standards. and also through the investment chapter with these international investment tribunals that could award millions or even billions of dollars in damages if big ag companies see their future profits threatened in this way. So you don't see China pushing for these corporate-dominated investment tribunals that would in effect levy heavy fines on governments that seek to protect the public. So there are larger geopolitical concerns in terms of whether, you know, creating an economic bloc, and in mm-hmm. that connection, you know, President Obama and the United States ought to be looking for the kind of agreements that bring people together on equitable terms rather than subject them to, in effect, corporate rule. And in that way, I think you would be able to build a system of economic cooperation that benefits everybody and improves the strategic, political, and military position of the United States. But because it's such a corporate-driven agenda, it's self-defeating.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing about it that sounds, you know, kind of self-defeating or you know, very worrisome, obviously, is, you know, talking about the tribunals that you're mentioning. I mean, if they're suing governments, and we all know that it's a big problem when anyone is up against a corporation, but that's going to cost millions of dollars in the event. I mean, you know, here we have a government that can't, you know, and an economy where we can't kind of keep up with our, you know, ongoing responsibilities that we've always hoped to keep up with, and now they're going to have to pay legal costs or else just kind of fold and not, you know, take a stand for certain things because, you know, they're going to be sued. I mean, that's going to come out of it, would seem to me, the computers, you know, the consumers and the citizens' pockets. I mean, if companies can, you know, or these tribunals can allow companies to sue the government, you know, how is that something that government would want to put in place?
Well, it doesn't make any sense to me because it undermines our courts and the authority of our legislative bodies. This is actually something that a lot of conservatives are very upset about, too. In terms of American sovereignty, the integrity of the law, the integrity of our court system, so it's a very, very big problem. But you know, this is again a procedural measure that's very complicated, and people don't understand, you know, reflexively or immediately because it's procedural and because it's a legal complexity. But it is maybe the most dangerous thing about both the Pacific and the Atlantic Agreement. And I think it will be, and we have seen suits in the past that have focused on dangerous chemicals and rolling those back. You know, there may be fewer investment suits on at the border food safety issues just for a variety of technical reasons, but those decisions will be done by other tribunals that are not that are government to government dispute resolution that also go around the U.S. Court system. So I want to be factual here in that you will see these investor state tribunals dealing with issues that have a long-term effect on food safety because, you know, chemicals are the kind of thing that they would litigate on. Food safety litigation, investor states, less common, but there's another kind of tribunal that will deal with those cases.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not quite as bad as the investor state tribunal, but it's plenty bad enough because they can enforce their decisions very effectively by applying retaliatory trade sanctions like higher tariffs on American exports, or withdrawing the intellectual property protection of let's say software companies and so forth, and that will cause even the United States government to reverse policy pretty quickly as well.
Yeah, that sounds.
This is getting very technical here, but I want to be precise so that,
right.
You know, if the other side's listening in, they don't accuse me of misrepresenting. And, it, and it's a little dense for your listeners, but please bear with me because I want to make sure that we understand how dangerous this is, but I don't want to say anything that could be regarded as an exaggeration. And if anything, I think I'm understating it.
Right. Well, you know, I've just kind of in a way been having a similar thought because the thing, you know, that I hear from people, like, for example, you know, because I'm constantly, you know, reading out in social media and I'm reading current articles and, you know, and I see people's comments and, you know, in terms of where public understanding is around these issues. And sometimes, you know, just the other day I saw something where someone was kind of, you know, hand on hip and going, what's wrong with the EPA? Tell them to, you know, why haven't they dealt with these chemicals? You know, what, you know, isn't that their job? Actually, the thing that they happened to be going on about was a food additive, which was the FDA's job and not the EPA's job.
Yeah, right.
But that's
right.
A different question. But I think what most people don't really understand is that, you know, laws were passed and, you know, the EPA and other agencies are not allowed to do their job because of the threat of lawsuits and corporate pushback. For example, just this last week was the 40th anniversary of Saturday Night Live, 40 years, you know, on the air and all of that. Well, that, and then they, you know, were mentioning that's 1975. Well, 1975 was also the year that the original, you know, Toxic Substances Control Act bill, which was supposed to study and find out the dangers and regulate these many chemicals that are in all of, you know, kinds of consumer products, not to mention industrial outputs, all of that was supposed to, you know, way back when, 40 years ago, and it hasn't happened because, you know, nobody empowered the EPA, and instead they were overwhelmed by corporate pushback. And so that's just within our own legislative and regulatory process and legal system. That's before we have, you know, this coming in. And then there was the next step of trying to, you know, put in a better bill. That couldn't make it to the floor because of the corporate pushback. So now we're seeing, you know, it's not even going to be anywhere close. And, you know, people are just waking up to the fact that, hey, this should be regulated and maybe some agency should do it. So we're kind of, we're way behind in really understanding what's been going on and the role of policy and regulation. And as we're behind, these initiatives are advancing and going further to, you know, remove rights in, you know, in ways that you're describing, which are highly, highly problematic. Now, I just want to also add that the other thing I hear, just to talk a little bit for our listeners, because this is very timely. Votes are going to be coming up soon to quickly pass this legislation or these trade agreements, you know, agree to them by a process called fast track. And one of the things that I hear a lot about, you know, people hear the phrase fast track, they see a couple of people out there with signs that they know are opposed to it. Well, gee, what could the problem be? And, you know, you and I have had some exchanges about this because people say to me, oh, it couldn't be that these are it's kind of a double bind. On the one hand, it couldn't be that these are going to be passed in secrecy and that the public won't know what is exactly in the treaties and that even Congress won't know if it goes through by fast track exactly what is in the treaties. On the one hand, people think, well, that isn't possible. On the other hand, they think, well, if treaties have to be negotiated in secrecy, we don't really know what's in the treaties. So maybe the things that you're describing aren't really there or won't really be happening. And so if they hear President Obama or someone else offer a reassurance, I know someone who, you know, is an industry leader that met along with other industry leaders with the president and was assured that this isn't going through. Nothing like this could possibly be happening. So I want to talk about secrecy for a bit because it's very important, listeners, if we're going to take action on this, which we need to do. Going to stopfasttrack.com and regularly signing up to write all of your congressional and Senate representatives, you know, and letting your feelings be known to stop this. It's very important to talk about secrecy because that's a big thing here, both secrecy in terms of could it be happening that this is going through and happening before we know what's in it? And second, how do you know what's in it?
Well, we know some of the provisions because they've been leaked, mainly by our negotiating partners. I mean, I get documents all the time now from Brussels, where perhaps a European bureaucrat has handed it to Friends of the Earth Europe, who passes it on to me, and we know in detail a lot of the food safety and chemical issues as a result of those leaks. WikiLeaks has released certain chapters of both the Pacific and the Atlantic Agreement. And I go to the negotiations, and I have side conversations with the negotiators from other countries, and they don't give me documents necessarily, but they give me information on the gist of it. And so we have, and beyond that, there are extensive public documents from industry groups and from the U.S. Trade Representative's Office on what their general objectives are. For example, every year the U.S. Trade Representative's Office publishes a sanitary and phytosanitary measures trade barrier report, which is basically a long list of food safety and animal and plant health regulations in other countries that the United States negotiators want to knock down in whatever negotiations they may be participating in. And that's that's very clearly documented. So we piece it together, but it's still no substitute for having the full document in front of you, because these are very clever lawyers that work for the corporations and for the U.S. Trade Representative's Office. And we really have to go through it microscopically to find out how bad it might be. And there's no opportunity to do that with Fast Track, because what it would do is provide for a quick up or down vote with no amendments on the Pacific deal and the Atlantic deal at a later date. And the history shows that under those kind of rules, with heavy industry pressure, that it's almost impossible to stop a trade deal. If, on the other hand, you use the procedures that the Founding Fathers laid out in the Constitution, where the primary responsibility for making trade policy was with Congress, and there would be an opportunity to carefully review and so forth, then you see that these bad trade deals don't get pushed through until their provisions are fixed. So again, they're using a clever procedure to hide substance. In effect, the real vote on the Pacific Atlantic deal will be the vote on Fast Track, even though it won't be technically a vote on those two deals. But once those procedures are in place, you know, it'll be a locomotive at high speed, and it'll be pushed through the congressional process with almost no hope of stopping it. And that's before anybody, except a limited number of people, have had a chance to see the text. It's outrageous.
That's incredible. Does the, you know, I'm also expecting, you know, because what often happens, I mean, one of the things that occurs when you are, you know, a media watcher and media analyst, in a sense, which is what I am, right, being a journalist, I'm both reporting and I'm also looking at how things are reported, how public opinion is swayed, how the truth is revealed, you know, because a lot of ideas and attitudes that people adopt about things that are out there in our world and therefore represented in the news, you know, they think they've adopted an attitude and this is their belief, but in fact they have been swayed and they have been influenced, you know, by a certain kind of, you know, and very often wherever you hear PR statements of various kinds or fear tactics of various kinds, it's because, you know, there's some manipulation at play that's kind of reeling you in, and even reporters get reeled in. This happens a lot in the health area. There's a lot of reporting in the health area by people really who don't have a health background, and therefore, which, you know, I do, but, you know, therefore, they're, you know, they'll listen to the most powerful person that can get to them and think that they have resolved a health concern, for example, and that they really, you know, kind of have the grasp of the issue, and then it hardens into belief, and that's happening all the time, and it's not by happenstance. So, you know, I'm kind of looking at all of these sort of things all the time in terms of how these are represented. And so it's also one of the reasons why I think, you know, people who have a lot on their plates, they see these obscure initials, they hear treaties and they think this has nothing to do with me, you know, and that's why we're doing this show, And the prior show that we did with you and the other five shows that I did before that on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and these deals, so that people can be better informed. It's not being reported in the mainstream press apart from a very few places. It's kind of a non-event, and yet it could change our whole landscape in regards to food, as we've discussed today. And in the prior show we did, we talked also about the environment. So I just want to mention also to listeners, please go to the Connect the Dots archives and listen to the other shows. Put the one with our today's guest, Bill Warren, at the top of your list. Take action at stopfasttrack.com, and you could do it every day, as a matter of fact. And then tell other people. Like the show on iTunes. Share this program. Share links that I provide on my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health. On this issue, as well as on the Friends of the Earth website, the organization for which Bill Warren labels long and hard. I've been reporting and will be continuing to report on this issue on Alternet. So right now I have something up on the Alternet environmental page. Will the Trans-Pacific Trade Pact deepen our climate change nightmare? I'm going to be doing more reporting on this topic, so please do a Google search of my name, Allison Rose Levy, Alternet, and, you know, find those articles, share them with people. The more people that are informed, the better our opportunity to do something about this. And the final point I'm going to make is that I would not be surprised, based on what I've seen, for there to be some, you know, kind of big hullabaloo event that's like a relatively minor importance in the bigger scheme of things, because that's what we're talking about here today with Bill Warren, is the bigger scheme of things. During the same time frame, I would expect, you know, a scandal of some kind or people to be distracted by something that kind of makes this take a back burner. Let's see if I'm right. I hope I'm wrong. Let's see if I'm right. But don't lose your sights on this, listeners. Go to Friends of the Earth, go to Stop Fast Track, follow me on Alternet and Facebook, and really stay in touch with what's going on, because it's only through citizen pushback that, you know, that we can really stop this. And we also have an ally in Bernie Sanders. Follow what he's up to on this, because there will be a host of action opportunities coming down the pike. Now, I just want to sort of step into that then a little bit with you, Bill, and find out, do they have the votes to push this through, or does the public have the ability to stop it?
The public definitely has the ability to stop it, but they need to, as you suggested, talk to their member of Congress, especially their House member, as soon as possible. There are a lot of undecided votes here. I mentioned before that conservatives have some problems with the threat to U.S. sovereignty and the threat to the rule of law under these agreements. And there's a group of about 30 Republican members of the House that will be bucking the corporations and the leadership on this. And there are another 70 who are undecided. And by the same token, the vast majority of the Democrats in the House of Representatives are fighting the president on this, but there are some swing votes. They're often the people identified as new Democrats, sort of the Bill Clinton business-friendly, social issue-friendly, but business-friendly people. And that's where things are being thought right now. So we need to talk to people like Earl Blumenauer, who has a wonderful environmental record but is leaning a yes toward fast track, to people like Jared Polis in Boulder, Colorado, who has a fabulous record on the environment and food safety but is a pro-corporate guy in many other respects. Mm-hmm. And there are a whole list of people who generally have good environment and food safety records who, you know, may not be particularly close to organized labor, or maybe opposed to organized labor, and organized labor is opposed to these agreements and so forth. But these are sort of business-friendly people who want to be good to the environment, and people like Polis and Blumenauer need to understand you can't square that circle. You can't be for the environment. You can't be for food safety and help out the corporations in your district in the way you want to. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we can communicate as people who come from a progressive point of view to those swing Democratic votes, we're going to win this, because I think there will be enough conservative Republicans who will buck the leadership and the corporations on this, so that you will have a left-right coalition, and they won't be able to get the vote count to proceed with a vote in March or April or May. And I do
think
that what they're aiming for right now is a quick vote in March before members of Congress have a chance to fully grasp this. So people need to talk today to their member of Congress.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I mean, we're doing this in a very timely way to give you that opportunity. It's hopeful, listeners, which means your action is important. It doesn't mean it's a shoo-in. I keep citing on the show the fact that for those who care about mandatory labeling of GMOs in the state of Oregon, in the recent referendum with tens of thousands of dollars of corporate monies buying ad campaigns, et cetera, to influence people and actually mislead people. As we heard on a recent program with Lisa Stokey of Food Democracy Now!, which you can also check out in the archives, that vote lost by under 900 votes. So, you know, when we're at these critical thresholds, your participation really counts. As we've heard here from Bill Warren of Friends of the Earth, our guest today, you know, there is a possibility, a strong possibility to swing this. That doesn't mean it's a certainty. That doesn't mean you can sit back. This is the time not to do that. This is the time to lean forward, take action, and let other people know. Recruit your friends. Tell them. Be a little bit of the pain in the butt. I mean, they'll thank you later. Speaking as one who's ready to be a pain in the butt at any time. Do it nicely, whatever. Pass the show along to other people, and pass blogs and other things. Is there a place online where people can find a list? And if not, maybe we'll create and post one. So check back and we'll kind of figure out right now how we could do that. Where there's a list of the people on whom to lean. For example, you mentioned this gentleman from the state of Colorado. Mm-hmm. I have friends in Colorado. So if we had a list, and then we could kind of go through that list and say, I have friends here, I have friends there, these people are their constituents. This is participation in the democratic process to make sure that we still have a democratic process going forward. Is there a place where people can go and find out who the most crucial votes are to, you know, kind of lean on?
Well, we have a list circulating right now of members. We're staging demonstrations this week.
Mm-hmm.
But I can provide you with a list of people who have strong food safety records or who may lean our way on food safety, and who are very much in play, and I will make that available to you, Allison, if you want to post that.
I will post that. I will absolutely post it. So listeners, sign up to get alerts from my Facebook page, like my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health, or my personal page, Allison Rose Levy. Also keep checking for the alternate articles, because I will also try to give that information in some of my upcoming articles covering these issues on Alternate. So that'll be terrific. Thank you so much, Bill. And, you know, your work on this has just been truly awesome.
Your reporting on this is awesome. If I may interrupt, I want to get in a word edgewise and say I think you're really doing fabulous work.
Thank you. So we're the awesome club here.
Okay.
the thing is, it's really amazing. I just want to also, just in line with your awesomeness, to say, you know, it takes not only a detailed knowledge of the legal stuff, and I think we've done a pretty good job of kind of threading through it. But if people have any questions, please do also let us know in the forums that we mentioned, so that we can answer them. But you know, you're both the combination of your legal and trade background, along with the commitment of Friends of the Earth to protect the environment and our health in all of these wonderful ways, has really meant that you were able to go to these meetings and to have the network of personal relationships, to have these private conversations, to pour through these long-winded documents that have everybody, you know, kind of overwhelmed and kind of ignoring the thing because they just seem so dense and beyond us, and to do this interpretation. So, you know, this is also, you know, we wouldn't really have bona fide information without that. And so I also want to once again invite listeners to support Friends of the Earth and other activist organizations that are working in this arena. It's super important because the job of protecting us that government has been there to do and that we hope or assume that they are doing, or we complain when they're not doing it, they won't be doing it. They won't be able to do it if we lose this handle on democratic process around health, food, and the environment. So it's really important not to. It's really organizations like Friends of the Earth and Progressive Radio Network, that do the hard work of replacing, you know, what government should be doing with providing you with the information, and the kind of directive of where and how to act. And so, you know, this is super critical, important. I think, you know, I've dropped a lot of other priorities because I've covered fracking, I've covered toxic chemicals, I cover food issues, you know, and I'm not really pushing on climate change. I'm not really pushing on any of these fronts right now because this will change the game on all of them. Super important to act. StopFastTrack.com if you can do nothing else, but please do more if you can. Talk to your friends. Let more people know if you care about your food and your health and our environment. So concluding thoughts from you, Bill, about this as we near the last three or four minutes of the show.
Well, I would just reiterate that we have this vote on Fast Track potentially coming up very soon, and people need to talk to their member of Congress, because once Fast Track is in place, it will be extremely difficult to stop the Pacific or the Atlantic deal, and we don't even know in detail what's in there. I mean, I have a pretty good idea in general terms, but it could be even worse. And we're not getting the reporting from the mainstream media, except for maybe Ed Schultz on MSNBC and a couple of others, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we need to people need to talk to their neighbors. They need to talk to their friends, and especially if your neighbor or your friend or your old classmate is in a key congressional district, to make it a point to communicate very strongly to these swing members of the U.S. House of Representatives, who really kind of hold our fate in their hands.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Bill Warren of Friends of the Earth, for your second appearance on the show. Let's hope that we're celebrating a win stopping Fast Track over the next time period, and we'll stay in touch on later developments and keep you all informed as well, listeners. Thank you for being with us today for Connect the Dots. Tune back in next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great week, a healthy week. Take action, an activist week. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Thanks for being with us.